welcome to Talk of the Bay. I'm your host, Deanna Zachary, and tonight we're talking about girl culture, girly culture, feminism, and young women who say they are not feminists. Programming support is from Solar Mike and Echo Energies, providing solar electric systems that run meters backwards, presenting a public seminar on solar electricity Saturday the 27th. Information from Solar Mike at 427-9070 or on the web at echoenergies.com. The views expressed on this program are not necessarily those of KUSP. A cover of Time magazine in 1998 asked the question, is feminism dead? A Time CNN poll that same year said that more than 50% of women between the ages of 18 and 34 say they are sympathetic to feminist values, but they do not necessarily call themselves feminists. Tonight we're going to focus on these young women and the cultures that they create. We have with us the two authors of a book called Manifesta, Young Women, Feminism, and the Future. I'd like to introduce Amy Richards, who is the co-founder of Third Wave, a national activist organization for young women. Amy Richards used to be a research assistant to Gloria Steinem and later became a contributing editor to Ms. Magazine. Amy Richards, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I'd also like to introduce Jennifer Baumgardner, who was an editor at Ms., and she's now a freelance writer. Jennifer Baumgardner, thank you for joining us tonight.
My pleasure.
Jennifer, let me begin with you for just a moment. How do you account for the fact that 50% of young women say they are not feminists?
Well, if they do, if 50% of young women do say that, it's still much more than I've ever said that they were feminists before, women that have ever said that they were feminists before. And one of the big premises in Manifesta, the book that Amy and I co-wrote, is kind of trying to let younger people off the hook a little bit about their complicated relationships to feminism. And I think that if you look at how they live their lives, they're very much embracing feminism. You see that in the fact that young women go to college and they take engineering courses and not just traditionally female courses. You see it in the jobs that they take on and the fact that they'll have a family and a job. And you see it in the fact that they're in sports, all these different ways. The fact that they express their right to choose, you know, in the abortion sense or in the having a family sense. But I think that because we were raised with feminism as this vibrant force when we were born, Amy and I were both born in 1970. There's this sense that like any ambiguity that we might have about feminism or any question we might have is a rejection, and it's just simply not. When we're traveling around the country, we hear, I am a feminist, but you know, they don't prioritize, you know, childcare enough, you know, all these different things. And so I actually don't think it's a problem about how many people are calling themselves feminists. And the ones that aren't yet, it's usually because they don't really know what it is or how it relates to their life.
Would you say, I'll ask this of Amy, that people think, a lot of women think feminism is something, they don't want to call themselves feminist because it means something negative to them?
Well, I think, I mean, going back to your initial question, instead of focusing on the 50% who don't call themselves feminists, I focus on the 50% who do call themselves feminists. And I think even more broadly, focus on those who are simply living feminist lives. I mean, we look at Mia Hamm, who's a professional soccer player and who has started a whole professional women's soccer league with competitive salaries and competitive jobs. And that's very much a feminist act. Whether she calls herself a feminist is irrelevant to me because her actions speak so much louder than her words. And I think, I mean, knowing from my own example, calling yourself a feminist means you can't let certain things slip by. And that's a lot of responsibility to take on. I can't sit in a room and have the racist joke happen and me not say that's not funny. And then the minute I single myself out as the person who is saying that's not funny, I have to take on the responsibility of why isn't it not funny? What makes it not funny? And so when some people are rejecting that feminist label, I think it's because they're acknowledging that they're not ready for that responsibility. And I have to respect that.
Mm-hmm. And explain to us the difference between first wave, second wave, third wave, because what you're working on in your book is third wave feminism. So perhaps, Jennifer, you could talk a little bit about
that. Sure. Yeah, the waves. We always get asked about wave theory, so now we've actually had to create a theory to to fulfill this question. But historically, historians, you know, looking back at the feminist movement, have, just purely for convenience sake, divided it into these waves. And the first wave was roughly 1848, which was the call for the vote, the formal call for the vote at Seneca Falls, vote for women. And we achieved the vote. I mean, none of us were alive then, but we achieved the vote in 1920. So that's 72 years later. That was the first wave historically of this movement, the women's movement. You know, it encapsulated several generations of women in several different pushes. And the women that initially called for the vote were dead by the time we got the vote. And also, many things were changed along the way, and this is how movements work. For example, the right to inherit property, women achieved that right. The right to divorce, the right to have custody of your children. These were all things women didn't have prior to that. And so rights of citizenship in the American democracy was gained by the first wave. And then the second wave, which came about immediately after the first wave and by the women who were involved in the end of the first wave, was the right sort of to equality. And the way it's most manifest is in the concept of an Equal Rights Amendment, which Alice Paul wrote in 1923, in which there was a very active push for it in the second wave, you know, the push for equality in the 70s, and then it kind of fell apart in 1982. But the Equal Rights Amendment would be maybe the symbolic act of this second wave. And then the reason we call ourselves the third wave was to just sort of make it's not that there is a different political goal yet. We're still working on equality, not just the Equal Rights Amendment, but equality legislatively, equality in our homes, equality in our minds, you know. But we're a generation that was raised with this feminism, a really vibrant feminist movement in the water. And in order to sort of shine a light or give some visibility to all the young feminists that we see, we utilize this term third wave, and other people do too. But Amy also then coincidentally co-founded a group called Third Wave, which is sort of a separate entity.
And Third Wave, I mean, uniquely or not, is specifically for young feminist activists roughly between the ages of 15 and 30. That's not kind of a hard and fast deadline. It's more of a sensibility than a requirement that you fit that age. But based on that, it's not meant to move with that generation. Third Wave is always meant to kind of be there, set in stone, as young women and men transition kind of from that phase of, I think, being a girl to being a woman, or being a boy to being a man. And that's not so much picking up on the idea of a wave of feminism, but it's very much picking up on giving visibility to young feminists. And as Jennifer had said earlier, it's very different to grow up with feminism in the water. It gives you a different association. And I think that the way that manifests in the lives of young women and men goes back to their living feminist lives. And I think that Third Wave Foundation is trying to literally give a foundation to that leadership and to that act of living feminist lives, whether or not you're identifying it as such.
Mm-hmm. What would you say are some of the activities of young feminists? I mean, if the vote was first wave and the Equal Rights Amendment or fighting against domestic violence or rape was the second wave, what activities are young feminists engaged in?
It really depends on the young feminist, but there's a lot of push right now to have employment health insurances cover birth control. A lot of people got angry when they realized that Viagra was covered and birth control wasn't. And that's a big campaign that's happening now and mostly being undertaken by people who are on birth control, which are women in their 20s and 30s and teens. The activism that we've seen around anti-globalization and kind of the frustration with this corporate power structure is very much being undertaken by young people, kind of fed up with getting our news and our milk from the same company. It's everything's owned by one. And the other thing that I see young people being really activists around is the environment, prison industrial complex. You know, why are all these corporations allowed to go into a prison, pay below minimum wage, really a pittance for work that, you know, is being done in a prison that if they were not prisoners, they would have to pay a livable wage too. The whole idea of a living wage is campaigning that's been happening around this country primarily on behalf of young people who've been saying a minimum wage isn't enough. We need to have a livable wage.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, the examples that Amy gives, I think, point to something that might be, again, slightly different about not so much this generation of feminism, but feminism right now for everyone who's engaged in it, which is that it's not so much about these, to some degree, mythical women's issues. It's about every issue and it's putting this lens on to look at it, well, how does this affect women? And so I think that's probably one of the reasons that feminists, younger feminists, seem so invisible or as if they don't get it or if they're not active. It's probably because they're in some ways working on issues that aren't construed as being feminist for whatever reason. Like if it's not abortion rights, it's not feminist, you know? So the examples that Amy gave with prison industrial complex or fair labor, those are feminist issues, but I don't think that they're approached by the media that way. And they might not even be approached by some old school feminists that way.
I mean, sadly, the only thing that people see as feminist issues are when the organization is feminist in its title, or like the National Organization for Women, or Ms. Magazine, or the Feminist Majority Foundation. But those, and all of them would argue this, are multi-issue. And Third Wave Foundation is the same way, multi-issue organizations. And for every one of those umbrella national organizations, there's hundreds of local organizations that are really working piecemeal on individual issues. And as Jennifer said, when you break it down past the national organizations, it opens your eyes to what feminism really is. It really is living wage. It really is adequate child care. It really is adequate health care.
Because I think some people would say, look, we know these feminist leaders of the first wave, Sojourner Truth or Susan B. Anthony, and of the second wave, Gloria Steinem, Betty Friedan, Angela Davis, we have names to attach to those movements. But then who are the leaders or who are the names that we attach to the third wave feminism?
Yeah, well, that's a good question, and we have a good evolved answer, I think, which is that it's a sign of our strength that we don't have to be reduced to two or three women. There are so many activists out there who are feminist activists that we are all the, you know, I'm the Angela Davis of my life and of my neighborhood, and Amy's the Gloria Steinem of her world, and we are all on a private level. We are that big, you know, and the way that we phrase it in the book, or the quote that we, that Amy found actually, that we refer to all the time, is the public heroines of one generation. What was it? It was so moving. It'll never escape me. The public heroines of one generation are the private citizens of the next. And I think you really see that with the civil rights movement as well. You see it with you see it with the gay rights movement. There aren't going to be, or the gay rights movement is more ascendant right now, like newer. I mean, we have Ellen right now, this big pop culture figure who's, you know, kind of represents some sort of gay rights for us. But 20 years from now, there's going to be so many famous gay entertainers or famous gay people or just gay people that are out that hopefully we won't have to keep asking, who's the next Ellen?
Well, it misses the point of leadership, too. I mean, the point of being a leader is that you are moving people forward in new and different ways. And to replicate somebody's leadership is a compromise of leadership, or it's maybe a compromise of your uniqueness. And so to become the next Gloria Steinem is really just to pick up in, you know, what she started. And I think what I see tons of young people doing is defining their own leadership and in their own ways, which is actually an incredibly feminist proposal to reimagine leadership. Because I think historically, feminists have fallen into that trap of defining leadership in very conventional ways. Who gets quoted in the New York Times? Who gets access to Larry King? Whose book deals get the most money? Whose lecture fees are the highest? And who has been singled out by the mainstream as a leader? And I think that feminists who kind of fight that value that the mainstream society has had, because it's put women, people of color, gay people at a disproportionate position in society, then we need to challenge our own definition of leadership and to kind of revalue who are the leaders. I mean, in the African American community, it's the woman who cooks at the church every Sunday, you know, or it's the woman in the community that everybody can come to. In Native American communities, it's the medicine woman. You know, it's somebody who is not, by conventional standards, a leader. Mm-hmm. And so I think in the same way, third wave feminists are challenging themselves in that own way and trying to define leadership in new and different ways.
You've mentioned just in that answer about Native American or African American people, and there's been a real critique of second wave feminism as being white middle class feminism. Do you think third wave feminism is doing it differently? Is it more anti-racist or multiracial?
Yeah, I think it is in Jennifer. A way, but not because we're better and smarter and more socially conscious. It's because we, in the same way that we grew up with feminism in the water, and we just sort of were born into this world where a lot of critiques and a lot of change had happened. The civil rights movement had also occurred. Gay rights movement had occurred. American Indian movement had occurred. Farm workers movement had occurred. We came into a world that had been changed immeasurably by these movements. And specific to feminism, we came of age after there'd been the black-white split, the gay-straight split, the married-single split, like all these splits that were actually critiques of who can speak for feminists or who can speak for women and ways of renegotiating that. We grew up with those critiques. And so I do think that more there's maybe a more organic sense of dealing with race and dealing with class and dealing with sexuality issues, and not in that sort of like add gay person to make it diverse today, in this sense where it really comes across organically and naturally.
I think, too, that, I mean, quite simply, we live in more diverse times. And I think our definition of diversity has totally expanded. I mean, I think I worked 2 summers ago at the W.E.B. Du Bois Institute at Harvard University. And it's this wonderful kind of place of black intellectual thought. And you have Henry Louis Gates. And until recently, you had Cornel West and you had Jamaica Kincaid. Yet the system itself was very white to me. It was a 9-to-5 job. Your success was determined by your salary. You were expected to be published in The New Yorker, in Newsweek, in Time, and by these sort of set academic journals that were valued. And it made me realize how complex our impression of diversity is now. It's not so much to have somebody have a different skin or a different sexuality, and realizing that a white person and a black person, both straight, might have, you know, more in common than, you know, 2 black people have in common. And because there's all these other elements to it, and seeing how, I think September 11th really showed this too, is how immature in a sense our treatment of different societies and cultures are. It's almost been that our approach to diversity is how well you can conform to a white middle class heterosexual norm rather than changing the norm. And I think that's one of the reasons why feminism wrongly gets identified as a white middle class movement, because it only looks at what has been achieved so far, and what has primarily been achieved so far, at least through the lens of the mainstream media, mainstream society, is how well women and non-white people have integrated mainstream society. How many women senators we have, how many African Americans are in Congress, you know, how many Latinos are getting appointed to presidential nominations, who's on the Supreme Court, how many women CEOs do we have? And that's not the goal of feminism. It's not that women and non-white people and non-straight people integrate those professions solely, but that we raise the floor. And I think when you look at it in that more complete way, feminism is a more diverse movement, and we also realize how much further we have to go. Who has benefited thus far, and who is left to be helped by feminism?
Explain more what you mean about raising the floor in that example.
Well, I think, I mean, for instance, when we talk about the pay gap, we talk about 75 women make on average 75 cents to a dollar earned by men. That doesn't take into account women of different races, and when you factor that in, it drops to about 50 cents on the dollar for Latina women. I know it's ridiculous. But the value system, or I think what we're saying in feminism, is it's not so much that a woman and a man who have the same job be paid the same, but professions that require the same amount of work should be valued the same. And the classic example, we use it in Manifesta, many other feminists have used it, is why is it that childcare workers are so undervalued compared to, for instance, you know, parking lot attendants, firemen. I mean, now being a fireman or a fire person is something it's sacred. You can't criticize it.
Sanitation workers
or nurses compared to physician's assistants. And so I think greater feminist leap in raising the floor is any profession that is more than 60% female is traditionally undervalued in society. And the idea of raising the floor is raising the whole bar of what those professions are worth to us as a society. I mean, the argument you get back about, you know, firefighters or parking lot attendants is, well, those are really dangerous jobs. That's a lot of responsibility. And I would think that those of us who have children might feel that that's equally great of a responsibility and mm-hmm. equally a risk, you know, to be raising other people's children or to have them under your care for 8 hours a day.
Mm-hmm. I want to just remind listeners, you're listening to Talk of the Bay. We're talking about young women and feminism with Jennifer Baumgardner and Amy Richards, and they're both authors of Manifesta. Jennifer, you wanted to add something?
Well, yeah, I was just also thinking about how, in terms of looking at feminism's white middle class history, that's also just a really inaccurate way. I mean, I definitely agree that that's the history, that, you know, that's probably the history in the books or the history you've learned or what you've seen. But it's actually not even feminism's story. Feminism's roots have everything to do with Native American women in this country, you know, or on this land that became this country. They lived in egalitarian, there's some tribes lived in egalitarian societies that were total models for the early feminists. And women in tribes in New York State could vote, you know, Indian women could vote, where white American women were going to die before the vote happened, but they were, you know, actively agitating. So there were all these sorts of ways in which there was a dialectic, you know, between women of color and their rights and white women's rights, and I think that's become really marginalized. And also, if you just look at the 60s and 70s, black women were more into feminism than white women were. It's just when it became this institution, there were ways in which black women were sort of, you know, squeezed out or weren't made visible. But if you just looked at what feminism is, which is a set of values in some ways and a lens for looking at the world, black women were more attuned to looking at their lives in terms of, you know, having egalitarian principles. And that had to do with the fact that they were already dealing with civil rights. And also the fact that they were not dealing with some of the weird privileges that made white middle-class women feel oppressed. You know, they were already working. They understood that.
I want to now also move, because your book talks a lot about young women and girls. What is girly culture?
Well, girly culture, I think, I mean, it could be described as the Spice Girls. It could be described as Britney Spears or Madonna, or in kind of less mainstream ways, Bust Magazine or Bitch Magazine, or it's in some ways just this embracing of female things. When we talk about girly culture, we're very specifically talking about Bust Magazine, which is this great magazine, and their treatment of girly culture, which is in some ways related to Carol Gilligan's work. I mean, I don't know that Carol Gilligan has ever or would ever use that word girly to describe what she was talking about, but she was saying in her work, and Bust Magazine is saying in a very different way, that girl things are good. And to kind of say that it has to become blue rather than pink to make it value, and to say that wearing lipstick or high heels is stupid because they're girl things, then that's, as Jennifer and I say in the book, that's buying our own bad press. And what we're trying to say with our support of girly culture is, like, girl things are good. And if we really want, I mean, it's the same way that you shouldn't have to become white to be valued. You shouldn't have to become a boy to be valued. And you shouldn't have to take on masculine qualities. And in the same way that these girl qualities and girl things should be available to girls who want to choose them, they should also be available to boys who want to choose them. And the minute the kind of that half of it is complete, the minute they're open to boys too, they will become more valuable. You know, it won't be like, oh my gosh, you throw like a girl, to be like, cool, you throw like a girl.
Yeah. It's, well, a powerful, visible, valued femininity.
Well, you write this amazing sentence in the book. You said, girly takes the feminine and drains the weakness and inferiority from it. But what I want to ask, though, it sounds like girly can be putting on lipstick, wearing frilly clothes, putting on, I don't know, shiny.
Crying in the office. I mean, it can be.
But say if we take something like lipstick, or you do a great chapter on Barbie doll, and I want to talk about that in a second, but how do we know if putting on lipstick is girly culture or it's just trying to look pretty for men? I mean, an older feminist critique of makeup would be to reject that as part of the patriarchy.
But it's also bad, though, to reject lipstick to impress feminists. You know, if you feel drawn to, I mean, in some, you know, the same way a cigar is just a cigar, sometimes lipstick is just lipstick, and, like, put it on and stop worrying about, you know, the fact that everything you do has to, like, be sending 27 messages. I mean, that was the other thing I think we were trying to do, is demystify some of these things that women are drawn, some women, not all women, are drawn to doing, and make it not have to be this big, you know, feminist dilemma if you're wearing high heels one day. And it's interesting because I think that we've been really vindicated traveling around. We've gone to like 60, 70 colleges in the last year and a half, and we hear constantly some version of, can I wear a thong and be a feminist? I'm really into feminism. It changed my life, but I really love my extremely long hair and I color it, you know? And basically what they're asking is, can I be myself and be a feminist? And the answer is yes.
I think these young women, and this goes back very much to the question you asked at the beginning of the show of, you know, why don't young women identify with feminism? And sometimes it's because they don't think they can, because they wear lipstick or because they wear miniskirts or because they date boys. And what we're trying to say, we're not trying to say do anything and be a feminist, but we have to recognize that we grew up, a younger generation, with the critique of the media, with the critique of consumerism being sold to us. And we have that critique and we can still choose it. And the point of feminism isn't so much what choice you make, but the freedom to make that choice. And I think that we have to look at how certain women really are choosing it, not because patriarchy is telling them to, but because they want to. And I know this from my own example. I'm more likely to wear lipstick for my girlfriends. You know, my boyfriend hates lipstick. And when I get dressed up, it means more to me when one of my girlfriends says, oh, you look so sexy. Where'd you get that outfit? And I think women, I think that's also in a feminist analysis that hasn't happened, is how, one, competitive we are with other women, and but yet how that competitiveness can be really supportive and really encouraging with each other, and it doesn't have anything to do sometimes with the men in the room or the men in society.
Or sometimes there's no man in the room. Like, we bond all the time. We spend so much time alone together. I think I'm constantly putting on lipstick, and it's not because some guy is there to see me and I can, like, win over the beauty contest with Amy or something.
I know, but one example, too, just to make girly not so much about consumerism and lipstick is what I was saying. It's crying in the office. And one of the examples we use in Manifesta is sales. And traditional people that were good at sales were, you could make the most number of calls in an hour. And that's a very male style of being a good salesperson. Men don't talk as much as women, so they can make many more phone calls. But when they looked at women's style of being good salespeople, their clients came back year after year. They might have made fewer phone calls, but their clients stayed with them. And so companies have had to change their approach to sales by saying, okay, we can do both of these things. The girl way of doing things, which might be talking longer, isn't any less valuable than the boy way of doing things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Since I mentioned Barbie doll, I'll have to ask you real quick. We only got a couple of minutes, but a lot of people say, look, Barbie is this tiny thing. No woman can actually be like her. We should have different dolls. Barbie, you know, what do you say about that, Jennifer?
Well, in the book, we really try to demonstrate that girls do not, they don't confuse themselves with their Barbie. They know their Barbie is a doll. And in most ways, rather than letting their Barbie oppress them with her crazy, you know, RuPaul sort of body image, it's more likely that they use Barbie to play out their dreams or issues or problems in their lives. And we had all these examples of girls who had to come out of the closet about liking their Barbie. And they would do things like, you know, my parents were getting divorced and my Barbie was my friend. My Barbie was the only one I talked to. Or my sister got an abortion and my Barbie had to get an abortion all the time. You know, all these things where they're playing it out the way you imaginatively do.
Where's third wave feminism going? What's next?
What's next is, I think, a greater embrace of feminism in our own individual lives. I think our approach to feminism has been as an after school activity or an extracurricular activity. It's like, oh, how can I do feminism from 3 to 5 every day? And I think that how it's moving is more incorporating feminist values into our life, that it's no more valuable to be a feminist who works at Now than it is to be a feminist who works at Starbucks and insists that boys and girls are paid the same at Starbucks. And so I think it's locating the feminism in our lives rather than always trying to find the feminism outside of our lives. Or I hope.
Thank you so much.
Thank
and also,
you for having us.
I'd like to mention your website for Third Wave Foundation. It's www.thirdwavefoundation.org for people who want to get more information. I'd like to thank our guest tonight. We've been talking to Amy Richards, who is the co-founder of Third Wave, a national activist organization for young women, and author of Manifesta. Amy, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And we've been talking with Jennifer Baumgardner, a freelance writer and author of Manifesta. Jennifer, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure. Thanks.